Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado C1. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Sport stacking is using a set of 12 plastic cups and you stack them in a very specific sequence of pyramids and you are racing yourself and you're racing a timer.
It's a sport that you don't have to be tall. You don't have to necessarily be able to run quickly. As long as you've got the 12 cups, you've got a mat and you've got a timer, you can stack. It is all muscle memory. I mean, it's so fast when they get to this level that the naked eye cannot see it all.
He's 8 years old. He's very outgoing. He's had a big birthmark since he was born. And maybe 6 months ago or so, I just noticed he was being a little more self-conscious about it, keeping his shirt on whenever he's in the pool and stuff like that. So I just had the idea to get the same birthmark as he had and get it tattooed on the same part of my body.
Yeah, like yours. You're matching. You like it?
My brother David was 40. Him and his family, when they couldn't travel back, David's wife Christine had asked us all to send 20-second video clips. It got to Dad, and the minute he just said hello, the two of us just started cracking up.
3, 2, 1. Hello.
That evening I was like, this is so funny, I'm going to put it up online. When I went to bed, there was about 600 views on it. In the space of 24 hours, I think 23 hours, there was at 1 million views. I rang him on Friday evening to say, Dad, hello, David. The hashtag hello, David is trending. And, you know, as usual, he was like, to my mom, he was like, I'm trending now, Pauline. And then all you could hear in the background is, what does that mean?
Hey everyone, I'm Max Amana. I'm a no-waste chef and author, and today I'm so excited to share with you a simple and easy no-waste recipe to help you reduce food waste at home. And this is a recipe from my cookbook, More Plants, Less Waste. We're going to make my peel and stem soup. We're going to utilize the whole entire potato. 4.4 million potatoes are thrown away every single day, so we're going to utilize the whole potato, including the peel. We're going to get them nice and crispy as a nice garnish. And then we're gonna utilize the whole entire broccoli stalk. So nothing is thrown away. Join us now.
Having someone come in for the first time who's never tried Indian food and are completely engulfed by the experience, they truly realize that not only is it Indian food coming from a gas station and being served in a gas station, but that they would try it elsewhere. So by preserving traditional ingredients, traditional preparations, traditional recipes, we're staying true to not only ourselves, but the region of the food for which we serve. And we want to make sure that you're leaving feeling like you got the true experience.
My grandma is my best friend. So when COVID happened, I wanted to help her, support her, make sure that she's safe.
They're really, really close, and he befriended most of the senior citizens that lived in her facility. So he was aware of who had this problem and that problem. So for him, it was that sense of urgency that he really understood really early on.
So I used my life savings and I made care packs for seniors.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Kavanaugh.
I wanted to make sure that they know that they're loved. I have given out more than 600 care packs to senior citizens.
Keep up the good work.
We started getting people asking, well, can we drop off toiletry items? And we got donations coming in from all over the world.
And that's how I started my own community pantry.
As soon as I had a hold of her, I just said, hey, we're going to be okay. Like, you're okay. We're going to get in. And, you know, as soon as I kept repeating that to her over and over, my sister was actually on the beach and she'd warned me that there was a double up coming. That's why I picked her up and kind of just jumped into the wave, copping the hit of the wave on my back. And then we kind of got pushed down into the rocks a little bit. She had already got scratches all over her body, and you know, I got some down my back and a lot across my arms and stuff. For the situation we were in, we both came out, you know, pretty unscathed. And you know, at the end of the day, she's safe now. And to see how thankful she was, and to see her son.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Sport stacking is using a set of 12 plastic cups, and you stack them in a very specific sequence of pyramids, and you are racing yourself and you're racing a timer.
It's a sport that you don't have to be tall. You don't have to necessarily be able to run quickly. As long as you've got the 12 cups, you've got a mat, and you've got a timer, you can stack. It is all muscle memory. I mean, it's so fast when they get to this level that the naked eye cannot see it all.
He's 8 years old. He's very outgoing. He's had a big birthmark since he was born. And yeah, maybe 6 months ago or so, I just noticed he was being a little more self-conscious about it, keeping his shirt on whenever he was in the pool and stuff like that. So I just had the idea to get the same birthmark as he had, and get it tattooed on the same part of my body.
Yeah. Like yours. You're matching. Do you like it?
My brother David was 40. Him and his family, when they couldn't travel back, David's wife Christine had asked us all to send 20-second video clips. It got to Dad, and the minute he just said hello, the two of us just started cracking up.
3, 2, 1. Hello.
That evening, I was like, this is so funny. I'm going to put it up online. When I went to bed, there was about 600 views on it. In the space 24 hours, I think 23 hours, there was at 1 million views. I rang him on Friday evening to say, Dad, hello, David. The hashtag hello, David is trending. And, you know, as usual, he was like, to my mom, he was like, I'm trending now, Pauline. And then all you could hear in the background is, what does that mean?
Hey everyone, I'm Max Amana. I'm a no-waste chef and author, and today I'm so excited to share with you a simple and easy no-waste recipe to help you reduce food waste at home. And this is a recipe from my cookbook, More Plants, Less Waste. We're going to make my peel and stem soup. We're going to utilize the whole entire potato. 4.4 million potatoes are thrown away every single day. So we're gonna utilize the whole potato, including the peel. We're gonna get them nice and crispy as a nice garnish. And then we're gonna utilize the whole entire broccoli stalk. So nothing is thrown away. Join us now.
Having someone come in for the first time who's never tried Indian food and are completely engulfed by the experience, they truly realize that not only is it Indian food coming from a gas station and being served in a gas station, that they would try it elsewhere. So by preserving traditional ingredients, traditional preparations, traditional recipes, we're staying true to not only ourselves, but the region of the food for which we serve. And we want to make sure that you're leaving feeling like you got the true experience.
My grandma is my best friend. So when COVID happened, I wanted to help her, support her, make sure that she's safe.
They're really, really close. And he befriended most of the senior citizens that lived in her facility. So he was aware of who had this problem and that problem. So for him, it was that sense of urgency that he really understood really early on.
So I used my life savings and I made care packs for seniors.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Kavanaugh.
I wanted to make sure that they know that they're loved. I have given out more than 600 care packs to senior citizens.
Keep up the good work.
We started getting people asking, well, can we drop off toiletry items? And we got donations coming in from all over the world.
And that's how I started my own community pantry.
As soon as I had a hold of her, I just said, hey, we're going to be okay. Like, you're okay. We're going to get in. And, you know, as soon as I kept repeating that to her over and over, my sister was actually on the beach and she'd warned me that there was a double up coming. That's why I picked her up and kind of just jumped into the wave, copping the hit of the wave on my back. And then we kind of got pushed down into the rocks a little bit. She had already got scratches all over her body. And, you know, I got some down my back and a lot across my arms and stuff. For the situation we were in, we both came out, you know, pretty unscathed. And, you know, at the end of the day, she's safe now. And to see how thankful she was and to see her son.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Early one morning last summer, I stood inside a museum in Antwerp and watched as a painting was hung on the wall. When I walked in, the gallery was empty. To one side there was a crate about a metre square. Royal blue, it was unmarked apart from a code number, and a yellow stenciled sign reading, Lato da aprire, open this side. Although its home is nominally Florence, the painting inside was a seasoned traveller. It had arrived the night before from Sicily by road and under armed guard. The box looked entirely unremarkable. That was the point, I was told. Abruptly, there was a commotion. The curator of the exhibition, a visiting curator, a translator, an expert in Renaissance art, plus a clutch of hangers-on, burst through the doors. Two art handlers wearing gloves and sober expressions strode over to a table. On it, pliers, tape measures, and an electric screwdriver had been placed with a precision that would not have been out of place in an operating theatre. While the group noisily exchanged paperwork and air kisses, the visiting curator, who had accompanied the painting on its journey, gave the handlers sotto voce instructions. The crate was laid flat on the floor, its lid unscrewed, and the foam packing lifted out. The screws that would attach the painting to the wall were held up for inspection. She gave a curt nod of assent. The only sound was the squeak of one handler's trainers on the floor. As the final layer of foam came off, there was a flash of gold reflected on the gallery ceiling. Craning my neck, I glimpsed the edge of Caravaggio's Boy Bitten by a Lizard, one of the artist's most sensational early masterworks. A young face contorted in shock and pain, body twisted, eyes dark and cheeks flushed. Gently the handlers placed the painting, one of two authenticated versions, on the table. There was a scattering of applause. It was as though a celebrity had materialized in our midst. Even if you are an obsessive gallery goer, it's possible you haven't put much thought into how the works on the wall came to be there. The art world prefers it this way. What happens behind the signs reading No Entry, Installation in Progress remains a ferociously guarded secret. The only hint that this Song Dynasty bronze has arrived from that private collection in Taiwan, for example, is a discreet credit on the wall. It may be that, absorbed in our face-to-face encounter with the artwork, what Walter Benjamin described as its aura, many of us prefer not to gaze too deeply into that mystery. Yet the mechanisms required to get that bronze from Taipei to St. Ives, loan agreements, insurance, packing, couriering, shipping, handling, installation, are delicate, expensive, and complex. Behind every exhibition is an intricate logistical web that reaches across the globe. Institutions are under huge pressure to share collections, both in the UK and internationally. Missed Frida Kahlo at the V&A? It has recently opened at Brooklyn Museum, just as the Metropolitan Museum's 2017 exhibition of early Diane Arbus has come to London. The British Museum's A History of the World in 100 Objects is shortly to arrive in Hong Kong by way of Abu Dhabi, Taiwan, Japan, Australia and China. It has been on the road since 2016. Many museums now rely on blockbuster exhibitions to drive visitor numbers. Often, the only way of paying for these is to partner with another institution and send the show on tour. The demands of creating large shows populated with star loans and the logistics required to make them come together are intense. It has become a sort of arms race, said one curator I spoke to with a trace of a sigh. A hyperactive art market creates a momentum all its own. According to the most recent analysis, global art sales total nearly $68 billion, £52 billion, annually, a 10% increase since 2008, with some 40 million transactions made last year alone. Vast quantities of art are continually being shifted from auction houses to purchasers to dealers and back again, especially in the fast-expanding Asian markets. 2 decades ago, there were around 55 major commercial art fairs. Now, there are more than 260. The end result is that more art than ever, worth more money than ever, is travelling more than ever. Fine art shipping is expensive, specialised, and technically challenging work. Old masters are fragile, but some contemporary sculptures are so friable or so poorly fabricated that moving them anywhere is a major risk. And there is the added pressure of handling artefacts that are almost immeasurably culturally important.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Early one morning last summer, I stood inside a museum in Antwerp and watched as a painting was hung on the wall. When I walked in, the gallery was empty. To one side there was a crate about a metre square. Royal blue, it was unmarked apart from a code number, and a yellow stenciled sign reading, Lato da aprire, open this side. Although its home is nominally Florence, the painting inside was a seasoned traveller. It had arrived the night before from Sicily by road and under armed guard. The box looked entirely unremarkable. That was the point, I was told. Abruptly, there was a commotion. The curator of the exhibition, a visiting curator, a translator, an expert in Renaissance art, plus a clutch of hangers-on, burst through the doors. Two art handlers wearing gloves and sober expressions strode over to a table. On it, pliers, tape measures, and an electric screwdriver had been placed with a precision that would not have been out of place in an operating theatre. While the group noisily exchanged paperwork and air kisses, the visiting curator, who had accompanied the painting on its journey, gave the handlers sotto voce instructions. The crate was laid flat on the floor, its lid unscrewed, and the foam packing lifted out. The screws that would attach the painting to the wall were held up for inspection. She gave a curt nod of assent. The only sound was the squeak of one handler's trainers on the floor. As the final layer of foam came off, there was a flash of gold reflected on the gallery ceiling. Craning my neck, I glimpsed the edge of Caravaggio's Boy Bitten by a Lizard, one of the artist's most sensational early masterworks, a young face contorted in shock and pain, body twisted, eyes dark and cheeks flushed. Gently the handlers placed the painting, one of two authenticated versions, on the table. There was a scattering of applause. It was as though a celebrity had materialized in our midst. Even if you are an obsessive gallery goer, it's possible you haven't put much thought into how the works on the wall came to be there. The art world prefers it this way. What happens behind the signs reading, No Entry, Installation in Progress, remains a ferociously guarded secret. The only hint that this Song Dynasty bronze has arrived from that private collection in Taiwan, for example, is a discreet credit on the wall. It may be that, absorbed in our face-to-face encounter with the artwork, what Walter Benjamin described as its aura, many of us prefer not to gaze too deeply into that mystery. Yet the mechanisms required to get that bronze from Taipei to St. Ives, loan agreements, insurance, packing, couriering, shipping, handling, installation, are delicate, expensive, and complex. Behind every exhibition is an intricate logistical web that reaches across the globe. Institutions are under huge pressure to share collections, both in the UK and internationally. Missed Frida Kahlo at the V&A? It has recently opened at Brooklyn Museum, just as the Metropolitan Museum's 2017 exhibition of early Diane Arbus has come to London. The British Museum's A History of the World in 100 Objects is shortly to arrive in Hong Kong by way of Abu Dhabi, Taiwan, Japan, Australia and China. It has been on the road since 2016. Many museums now rely on blockbuster exhibitions to drive visitor numbers. Often, the only way of paying for these is to partner with another institution and send the show on tour. The demands of creating large shows populated with star loans and the logistics required to make them come together are intense. It has become a sort of arms race, said one curator I spoke to with a trace of a sigh. A hyperactive art market creates a momentum all its own. According to the most recent analysis, global art sales total nearly $68 billion, £52 billion, annually, a 10% increase since 2008, with some 40 million transactions made last year alone. Vast quantities of art are continually being shifted from auction houses to purchasers to dealers and back again, especially in the fast-expanding Asian markets. 2 decades ago, there were around 55 major commercial art fairs. Now, there are more than 260. The end result is that more art than ever, worth more money than ever, is travelling more than ever. Fine art shipping is expensive, specialised, and technically challenging work. Old masters are fragile, but some contemporary sculptures are so friable or so poorly fabricated that moving them anywhere is a major risk. And there is the added pressure of handling artefacts that are almost immeasurably culturally important.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
Another school day starts. Packing off kids in the morning always feels like a small victory over the logistical chaos that threatens to overwhelm family life. I'm the father of three boys, two in school, and the third will start next year. Every parent worries about education, but for the parents of boys, there's a particular concern. Boys do far worse than girls.
Extract 1.
What's particularly interesting in the 1980s and 1990s, people were concerned about girls in education. And now we have this really interesting reversal whereby, if anything, people are talking about a boy problem.
However you slice it, boys do significantly worse than girls. At age 11, 70% of girls reach the expected standard in reading, writing, and maths. For boys, it's 60%. At 16, girls win two-thirds of the top grades awarded at GCSE. How much is hardware, what children are born with? How much of it is software, how the pressures and expectations of the world shape them?
Extract 2.
Alan Ebenezer is the school's charismatic head, brought in to make big changes to boys' lives. At Fulham Boys' School, as the name suggests, they think the best way to address the gap is in a single-sex environment. There is also a big focus on discipline, turning boys into gentlemen, all underpinned by a solid Christian ethos. Old-fashioned, perhaps to some. But this school has the single-minded aim of getting boys to engage with education in a way they haven't for years, perhaps ever.
Extract 3.
Because boys falling behind at school affects far more than exam results.
It starts early, it continues throughout the life course, and has far-reaching effects for both the educational and labor market outcomes for men and women.
She's the co-author of The Rise of Women, The Growing Gender Gap in Education.
More than a decade ago, a colleague of mine and I were just having a casual hallway conversation. He had just been at an ice cream social for his school where they were handing out achievement awards. And he noticed that the great majority of the people receiving the awards were girls. And as we began digging into the data, we were really struck by a growing educational gap between girls and boys, especially in terms of completing college.
Extract 4.
In the UK, the figures are stark. Over a third more girls go to university than boys. It was in the mid-2000s that the lines on the graph crossed and women became the majority in higher education. For some subjects, not long ago seen as bastions of male privilege, the turnaround has been extraordinary. Today, for example, women make up about 70% of people starting law degrees in the UK. The first thing we need to do is identify what we are seeing. Is this boys dropping back, doing worse than in the past, or is the gap caused by girls pulling ahead and doing better?
Extract 5.
I would argue that the gender gap these days is largely due to women. Let me explain why. So as long as we've had good records in the UK, in the US, and elsewhere, we've seen that girls did better at school than boys. Girls outperform boys on tests 50 years ago. They outperform boys on tests today. The difference was 50 years ago, young men were more likely to pursue higher education than young women were. What's happening today is women are outperforming men in university in the same way that women have historically outperformed men in primary and secondary school.
Extract 6.
We found that school quality makes a difference, neighborhood factors make a difference, but above and beyond that still, the family background makes a big difference. In the case of relatively affluent, high socioeconomic status families, brothers perform similarly to their sisters. But the lower the level of socioeconomic status, the worse brothers did relative to their sisters in school. I think that there are at least two reasons why this may be the case. One is that, frankly, girls are less weak than boys biologically. We know this, for example, from fetal studies that boys tend to be weaker at birth than girls. And so if it turns out that females are more resilient than males, then that would stand to reason that females might be biologically less sensitive to poor environmental factors than males might be. That's one explanation.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract zero.
Another school day starts. Packing off kids in the morning always feels like a small victory over the logistical chaos that threatens to overwhelm family life. I'm the father of three boys, two in school, and the third will start next year. Every parent worries about education, but for the parents of boys, there's a particular concern. Boys do far worse than girls.
Extract one.
What's particularly interesting in the 1980s and 1990s, people were concerned about girls in education. And now we have this really interesting reversal whereby, if anything, people are talking about a boy problem.
However you slice it, boys do significantly worse than girls. At aged 11, 70% of girls reach the expected standard in reading, writing, and maths. For boys, it's 60%. At 16, girls win two-thirds of the top grades awarded at GCSE. How much is hardware, what children are born with? How much of it is software, how the pressures and expectations of the world shape them?
Extract 2.
Alan Ebenezer is the school's charismatic head, brought in to make big changes to boys' lives. At Fulham Boys' School, as the name suggests, they think the best way to address the gap is in a single-sex environment. There is also a big focus on discipline, turning boys into gentlemen, all underpinned by a solid Christian ethos. Old-fashioned, perhaps to some, but this school has the single-minded aim of getting boys to engage with education in a way they haven't for years, perhaps ever.
Extract 3.
Because boys falling behind at school affects far more than exam results.
It starts early, it continues throughout the life course, and has far-reaching effects for both the educational and labor market outcomes for men and women.
She's the co-author of The Rise of Women, The Growing Gender Gap in Education.
More than a decade ago, a colleague of mine and I were just having a casual hallway conversation. He had just been at an ice cream social for his school where they were handing out achievement awards. And he noticed that the great majority of the people receiving the awards were girls. And as we began digging into the data, we were really struck by a growing educational gap between girls and boys, especially in terms of completing college.
Extract 4.
In the UK, the figures are stark. Over a third more girls go to university than boys. It was in the mid-2000s that the lines on the graph crossed and women became the majority in higher education. For some subjects, not long ago seen as bastions of male privilege, the turnaround has been extraordinary. Today, for example, women make up about 70% of people starting law degrees in the UK. The first thing we need to do is identify what we are seeing. Is this boys dropping back, doing worse than in the past, or is the gap caused by girls pulling ahead and doing better?
Extract 5.
I would argue that the gender gap these days is largely due to women. Let me explain why. So as long as we've had good records in the UK, in the US, and elsewhere, we've seen that girls did better at school than boys. Girls outperform boys on tests 50 years ago. They outperform boys on tests today. The difference was 50 years ago, young men were more likely to pursue higher education than young women were. What's happening today is women are outperforming men in university in the same way that women have historically outperformed men in primary and secondary school.
Extract 6.
We found that school quality makes a difference, neighborhood factors make a difference, but above and beyond that still, the family background makes a big difference. In the case of relatively affluent, high socioeconomic status families, brothers perform similarly to their sisters. But the lower the level of socioeconomic status, the worse brothers did relative to their sisters in school. I think that there are at least two reasons why this may be the case. One is that, frankly, girls are less weak than boys biologically. We know this, for example, from fetal studies that boys tend to be weaker at birth than girls. And so if it turns out that females are more resilient than males, then that would stand to reason that females might be biologically less sensitive to poor environmental factors than males might be. That's one explanation.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 3. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.